oftentimes we tend to focus a lot on what happens at the national level, and hundreds and thousands of books would have been written about the democratic transition in Spain, in Indonesia, in Brazil. Mm-hmm. But when you think about what is going on in the villages, in the municipalities, that can be very consequential, because a lot of public good provision, a lot of decisions are taken at the local level, and we need to figure out how transition should also work, not only for the stability of the national government, but also to prevent elites being entrenched at the local level.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Post-war politics in Brazil was dominated by some large landowning families. How did their influence affect the development of Brazil? And what happened when their power was threatened by an unlikely source? And what can this teach us about elite control and economic growth? Claudio Ferraz of the University of British Columbia, Monica Martinez Bravo Semfia, two of the authors of a surprising analysis of six decades of Brazil's economic development. Frederico Finan is the other one. He's not with us today. They join me now, though. So, Claudio, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tim, for having us.
And Monica, welcome as well.
Thanks a lot.
Claudio, let's go back to Brazil in the 1940s, where your story starts. These families, these powerful landowning families, who are they? How did they get to be so powerful?
So 1940s in Brazil, Brazil was just exiting the first dictatorship that it has back in the 1930s. Brazil, like many countries in Latin America, had a very high concentration of land ownership. So the whole Latin America, once it became independent in the 19th century, it was not that the wealth was really shared with most of the population. So very few owners had a lot of the land. And because voting was actually not secret until the 1930s, the power that they have on the land also generated power in terms of politics. They could exert control over how people voted. So because of that power and because of the way that they could exert control over people, both through exerting coercion or like using violence and threats, but also through vote buying, through offering people things in exchange for voting, that generated huge power that was concentrated, especially so, and when agriculture was important for the economy, in the land of these landholders. So you have in most of the states, but especially so in many of the poorer states, you have few families that really dominate not only the economic activity, but also the political activity.
But by the 1940s, when Brazil was a democracy, was voting secret then? How did they retain their control?
Yeah, voting was secret starting in the mid-1930s. Brazil becomes a democracy again in 1945. But because exactly they have like a lot of economic power, most of the control was usually retained through the exchange of resources. So not only in Brazil, but in several countries in Latin America in the mid-20th century, clientelism was a very important practice. When we talk about clientelism as economists or political scientists, this is really the exchange of goods and services in exchange for votes. So a lot of households, and this is what dominated many of these small and rural municipalities, they would exchange the way they voted for favors and for goods and services that were distributed by these powerful families.
Monica, this is typical of the structure, certainly in Latin America, of a lot of societies at this time, but it's also been seen in many other countries around the world in history. How does this dominance by an elite, generally speaking, influence the pace of development?
Yes, definitely. It's not unique to Brazil. And as you said, there are many countries where we see entrenched elites controlling political power. And we think that this is detrimental for development, mainly because once you have a very powerful group that controls power and they are secure and they think that they are going to keep controlling it, they do not face competition from other political actors, right? And what that means is that at the end of the day, they might not have incentives to develop public goods or to offer goods that are complementary with economic activities. It's also the case that in order to retain and accumulate more power, they might have enough incentives to invest even in inefficient institutions, right? So there is a large literature suggesting that once power is concentrated, that would lead to extractive institutions that perpetuate power and economic resources being concentrated in few hands. And that's, of course, detrimental to economic growth and the prosperity of the society in general.
So, Claudio, back to Brazil. Chapter 2, I suppose, 1964, and a big event that threatens the control of these elites. What happened at this time and how did they react to it?
So the 1960s are a very complicated period in the history of Brazil. As I was saying before, Brazil comes out of a dictatorship, really enters the democracy again in 1945, but institutions never stabilized. There was always a fight between different groups, not only regionally, but also left-wing vis-a-vis right-wing. And the big mess starts when the president that was elected resigns. And at that time, actually, there was a strange institution because presidents and vice presidents were elected separately. They didn't have to belong to the same ticket, to the same party, and to the same coalition. So you can imagine that that's very democratic in some sense, but that can create a lot of conflicts between the president and vice president if they don't think alike. So the vice president elected was a left-wing politician that was actually the ex-minister of labor that had very progressive views on many things. And one of the things that really threatened the political elite at the time was this prospect of push for land reform, right? This idea that Brazil had been very unequal, especially in terms of land, for many, many decades. And it was important to do a land reform in order to bring landless workers also into the market for agriculture and reduce the inequality. And once the president resigns, this vice president comes to power, and many of the progressive ideas that he had, land reform was one of them, the elite starts to become very, very, very tense about this prospects of reform. So there's a combination of economic shocks that happen that really increase inflation, increase unemployment, and made the population be very dissatisfied with the elite and more conservative groups organizing themselves to try to block all this progressive agenda until it becomes a point where there is a political gridlock and the military does a coup d'etat. So the military does a coup d'etat. One thing that's important is the coup d'etat does not come out of the blue. It is done with the support of many of the conservative groups in the society, including rich families, including the industrial elite as well, including the church. So in the beginning, the military does the coup d'etat more as, well, this president screwing up the country. There's a lot of uncertainty. Let's try to calm things down. And then we'll devolve politics into democracy and we'll go over. That's how like the whole 1964 coup d'etat comes out to be.
But as you say, this is complicated, isn't it? Because there we have a coup that was designed to keep things exactly how they have been before. But your argument in this paper, if I get it, is that this was a change to the status quo. How so?
Yes, exactly. That's what's surprising. That's a contentious debate, right? Even in political science and history in Brazil. So when these military groups comes to power, they were supposed to give the political power back, right? They were supposed to say like, look, we came to power just to kick out this left leader that was like threatening you guys in the elite. Now we're going to give you back the power. They don't do that. There's several reasons they don't do that. But they claim, if you go back to speeches and a lot of historical documents, is that it was very important not only to stabilize Brazil in terms of inflation, prices, riots, protests, etc., but also to reduce corruption and improve economic development. So remember that the 1960s, this is the period where the Cold War, and especially communism, is a threat to many countries in Latin America. Many military and right-wing regimes are very worried about communism spreading across different countries. So this is after Cuba, and there are many, many threats in a lot of countries. Brazil is a very poor country, especially in the rural areas. So there's a lot of potential for rural workers to get organized in the threat of a communist regime. So the military claims like, look, we need to first get rid of corruption. You elite guys, you have been corrupt for many, many years. It's not coming out of the blue. We really need to fix this thing and get rid of corruption. And second, we also need to modernize the economy. Because if we don't modernize the economy and we keep a lot of people very, very poor without the basic rights, without labor rights, etc., communism is going to be a threat. So instead of giving the power back, surprisingly for many of these elites, they actually do not give the power back to these traditional economic and political elites, and they implement many reforms that will keep elections happening at the local level, but with a completely different set of political institutions.
So we have this flowering of local democracy. But Monica, there's not democracy now at the national level. The generals are in charge. So what can local politicians change in Brazil that might be important for development?
Definitely, throughout the history of Brazil, in many countries, local politicians played a big role, right? So First of all, they keep in control of local public good provision, right? Such as schools and hospitals, but or health facilities. But perhaps more importantly, particularly during this period, they also had strong links to agricultural producers. So if you think of these traditional elites that were in control throughout all this period, it's not that they only control the local government. As we leverage on our empirical specification, political power runs through families. And typically, while one person is the mayor of the city, another family member or individual within their close network might also be in charge of the big farms or a number of other businesses. So the importance also of who controls local power is that sometimes they can affect the market in a way in which there is not a level playing field for potential entrepreneurs or different producers, and that might be affecting development. It could be through improvements in governance, public good provision, but also indirect effects on how level is the playing field among private entrepreneurs and firms.
Well, this is a fascinating story. I'm enjoying the narrative so far, but let's have a look at the empirical strategy in a moment. A clip there of a patriotic song from the 1970s, which praised Brazil's peace, opulence, harmony, and even its well-made mountains. Este é o meu Brasil. Perhaps dictatorships don't always have the best pop music. So, first of all, Monica, if you're going to measure anything about this, I guess you have to measure in some way the power of these political elites. How do you measure the concentration of power here?
Right, so that's always a very challenging part. So in this setting, we leverage on the previous research in economic history and political science that have documented and argued that political power during this period ran through families. So it was a given family that was in power and sharing power between different members of the family, right? So what we did is to collect the names of all mayors that have served in different municipalities of three states. And then we count essentially how many of these mayors belong to the same family by tracing their surnames. So our key measure of political concentration essentially will calculate what's the share of elections or terms in which the same family has been in power. And in particular, for our main explanatory variable of interest, we focus on the pre-dictatorship period and compute the fraction, again, of elections that was under the power of the same family. And with that, we compute the Herfindahl index of political concentration. So this measure will take value 1 if the same family has been ruling throughout across the different elections, and will tend to 0 as power is more evenly divided across different families.
You're measuring across a long time in three different states. These are enormous regions in Brazil. What sort of social and economic factors can you control for across this time and this space?
Controlling for a rich set of factors is very important in our empirical design, because essentially what we're going to do is to regress a measure of long-run development, for instance, GDP per capita in the year 2000, on this initial measure of political concentration before the military dictatorship.
Yeah.
And what we think we want to capture with that specification is the fact that in the more concentrated places, the military dictatorship exerted greater effort to crack down this concentration of power and introduce more political competition. But of course, for that coefficient or to have that interpretation, would want to control for all factors that are determinants of long-run development that also correlate with initial levels of political concentration. Mm. So in our basic specification, we control for many important determinants of long-run development, such as demographic and geographic factors, longitude, latitude, distance to the state capital, and so on. And in a battery of robustness checks, we extend to a richer set of controls, including the share of the economy in agriculture, in industry, fraction of the population with different ethnicities, religious composition, even some political factors. And our results are very robust to this extended set of rigorous controls.
And it's the fact that the military cracked down more on the most powerful families that gives you a causal relationship here?
Right, that's our interpretation, exactly. Once we control for all these determinants of long-run development, the way we interpret our coefficient is that in the more concentrated regions, the military exerted and implemented a range of policies to try to foster more political competition and the entry of new political contestants. And that is, in a sense, what we argue our coefficient is capturing at.
So, Claudia, how did this military intervention work in these more concentrated regions? How did the institutions change?
The military dictatorship comes in and change the macro institutions of the country, right? You transition from being a democracy to being a non-democracy. As I was saying before, although they get rid of elections at the higher level for like governors and president, the elections at the local level for mayors still kept going. So the first thing that the military does is they get rid of all the traditional parties. They say like, look, these old political parties that had all these bosses, let's get rid of all those parties. Mm-hmm. We're going to have one party that's going to be the political party that's going to support the regime. And then we're going to actually allow for an opposition party. So all you guys that are there that want to compete in the election against us can all join if you want this other party and then compete in the election against the military-supported party. Now, the military had a problem, and the problem they had is that it might be that if you go to a city, for example, you had, say, two traditional families that were very powerful and they have been fighting for local power for many years, mm-hmm. and they both reach landowners right wing. They both are going to want to be in the side of the military power, yeah. but only one can get elected. So one institution that's very important that we discuss a lot in the paper and we believe is one of the main causal mechanisms to explain the effect on political competition is what we call the sublegenda mechanism. So what the military allowed was a party to have multiple tickets. The name of the party was Arena. So you can have a candidate called Arena 1 and a candidate Arena 2. So you actually have two candidates within the same party. Yeah. And then after the election, you'll just sum up all the votes and the opposition party could do the same, actually, up to three candidates. You would sum up all the votes and then whoever had the largest numbers of votes overall will win. And the candidate that had the largest number of votes will win. So that allowed for the elite, if there were like two important families aligned to the military dictatorship in that locality, to have two candidates running for office. What we document and that we what we think is the unintended consequence of this policy or this decision of changing the institutions is that that also allowed many times a third candidate to enter and run in this race. And that wouldn't have been possible before in the context where like two families were dominated the local politics. So this change in the political institutions and the electoral rules, we believe, was one of the main determinants that affected like political competition at the local level.
Now, the result of this political competition that's been brought in, according to your hypothesis, is a change in long-run development. What do we mean by that? What are we measuring?
When we say development, what we're trying to measure in the paper, we measure, like Monica was saying before, we measure income per capita, which traditionally is the measure of development that economists like to use. But we also have measures from the census, from, say, infant mortality, literacy rates. So if you think about like human development, those two things are usually very important, both education and health. And both things are direct determined by investments that local governments make in education and health. And we also have from another project that Fran Finan and I have worked for a long time, we also have some measures of corruption. Those measures of corruption are based on audit reports that are done starting the mid-2000s. We don't have them for like all the municipalities, but we do have them for a subset of municipalities. So we put those measures of corruption as well in the analysis. So we measure income per capita, we measure health and education, and then we have measure governance through these corruption measures.
And in these regions, you found that these measures, these indicators were different.
Exactly. So that's exactly what we find, right? So what we find is like, if we look at those measures kind of like today, in those places that used to be more politically concentrated, we find what we call this reversion, right? So places that used to do way worse before the dictatorship came to power, actually today, these municipalities look much better. And the way to explain why they look much better, then we look at political competition today as well, right? And the main mechanism that we put forth in the paper is this idea that those places that used to be more concentrated were the places that were more affected by this change in the institutions that led to more political competition. And then once you transition to democracy in 1985, those localities become more competitive even after you already enter into the democracy. So what we think is happening is that this long-term change in political competition through the institutional change led to more investment in public goods and public services that increase income, increase literacy rates, decrease infant mortality, and reduce corruption.
Monica, you said that when the military took power, they were concerned about improving the pace of development. Did they do everything through this institutional reform, or did they try more direct policies as well?
They also tried a number of different things, right? So one of their key policies was also trying to modernize agriculture. In part, also, it's hard to sometimes disentangle completely from the political angle, right? Because the agricultural firms tended to be very inefficient. And in part, this was driven by the control that these traditional landowning elites were exerting. So in order to also break this equilibrium of inefficient agricultural activities, they also had a program to extend agricultural credit to modernize and to facilitate the entry of new businesses, potentially more technologically advanced and more efficient. So we do find that in the regions that were initially more concentrated, there was a greater influx of agricultural credit. And we do see also that this led to a larger creation of new agricultural businesses. Again, we think that this is consistent with the story that we are suggesting, in which the more concentrated and agriculturally inefficient places, you know, were targeted for these stronger interventions, both with institutional reform and with this other type of economic policies. But it's true that this represents a challenge for our interpretation of results, because you could think that this greater deployment of agricultural credit might also have direct effects on economic development.
Yes.
So we do some additional checks, and for instance, we show that in our baseline specification, in which, again, we control for many determinants of long-run development, it doesn't seem that we find a lot of effects on agricultural modernization, right? Once we control for these underlying determinants of development. So it seems that our effects on the reversal and so on could be netting out some of these potential direct effects into the economy. And we do some further checks, for instance, by directly controlling for the changes in sectoral composition and the changes in credit, and all our results still go through. So our takeaway is that beyond this potential direct effect on the economy, we think that our specification holds that constant, and our estimates would still reflect these deep political changes that have fostered more political competition, and that's what we're identifying as the long-run effects in development.
I want to find out what you think we've learned from this. And Claudio, the first question, are you arguing that the military dictatorship was good for Brazil?
I think that's a very important caveat and very important conclusion. We're not arguing that at all. In fact, the military dictatorship, like for many other countries, I think, was terrible for Brazil in many dimensions. Mm-hmm. In the macro sense, it is true, though, that the highest rate of growth that Brazil had. It was during the military dictatorship in the 70s, right? People call it the little miracle. But it was kind of like a little miracle fueled by many artificial policies that once Brazil hit a huge crisis in the late 1980s, it completely collapsed. So although there is like very large economic growth and modernization in many dimensions, including the agriculture modernization that happened that was like long-lived, it's also true that in terms of economics, in terms of inflation and debt, and especially so inequality, so the huge increase in inequality that happened during the dictatorship in Brazil is long-lasting and seen until today. So there are many really bad consequences, not only economically, but also politically. Politically, in the sense of how much power the military had, even entering the democracy that we still see it until today, which is a huge problem. And that without even going to the huge human rights issues of people being tortured and people being killed and many of the human rights violations that happened during the dictatorship. So all we're saying is that during that period, despite all these macro changes happening, it was still true that if you look at the local level, things happen in a different way to different places, right? So even if the overall picture looked like that, still the case that some places that will have been left behind because of like the local dynamics and history, they fare better in the long run because of this increase in political competition.
So fast forward to today, and even if you spend a relatively short time in some of the poorer states of Brazil in the Nordeste, you see that they are still very unequal. And of course, Brazil is still politically very polarized. Is the story here that the power of the elites was constrained once and for all, or were the old elites just replaced by new elites?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's a fascinating question that I think fascinates many of us that we cannot completely answer in this paper. Mm-hmm. I think we get kind of like a kickstart to begin to answer this question in the sense that this large institutional change led to some of the changes. But as you're saying, it's not that we go from municipalities and localities that were like poor to being like super rich, right? They do better.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
many of them still lag behind. So I think looking to the future, we still need to understand better why is it the case that in some places you're able to increase political competition and replace the elites, while in other places, many of these families are able to come back after you transition into the democracy, and what kind of tools do they use to be able to come back? So hopefully that's a topic for future research. A lot of people would say that in the transition, media ownership is something that matters a lot. Many of these families were able to buy newspapers, get TVs and radios, and with that, you have a lot of political power. We have to think about also all the transition that happened, that we're talking about 1990s, 2000s. Brazil is way less agriculture, way more urban and industrial. So how do those industrialization, urbanization changes actually affect like political power? So there are many things that change that eventually I think we need more research in order to try to understand. But it's definitely true that in some of these localities, new elites come in and replace old elites, while in other localities, this kind of political competition allow multiple new elites to come in, which generates more political accountability.
Last word, Monica. Are there lessons from this that can be applied in other countries where there are elites and maybe undergoing or maybe about to undergo a democratic transition about how that can work well, how it could work better?
I think that there are important lessons to extract from here. So the first one is that local politics matter, and it matters quite a bit during democratic transitions and regime changes. In economics, but also in other disciplines, in history and political science, oftentimes we tend to focus a lot on what happens at the national level, and hundreds and thousands of books would have been written about the democratic transition in Spain, in Indonesia, in Brazil. Mm-hmm. But when you think about what is going on in the villages, in the municipalities, that can be very consequential because a lot of public good provision, a lot of decisions are taken at the local level. And we need to figure out how transition should also work, not only for the stability of the national government, but also to prevent elites being entrenched at the local level. And in that sense, the other takeaway is that oftentimes we tend to think of elite capture. And what we think is the combination of two things, one group controlling power, but that group also not facing competition from other groups, right? And what we see in this paper is that if we could think about conceptually disentangle those two things, it seems that the competition part matters a great deal. It might be equally important to limit the power of some entrenched groups. It could be equally important to foster competition from external groups. That idea that the transition should also foster that competition. Perhaps it's not a big deal to let the old regime elites to contest and to remain in power, but they have to face competition from new groups and in a level playing field.
Well, lessons from history that are so relevant in so many places today. Thank you so much for talking about them. Thank you, Claudio.
Thank you very much, Tim. It was a pleasure.
And Monica, thank you as well.
Thanks a lot.
The paper is called Political Power, Elite Control and Long-Run Development, Evidence from Brazil. And the authors are Claudio Ferraz, Frederico Finan and Monica Martinez Bravo. It is NBER Working Paper 27456, if you want to find it that way. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure that you don't miss any Vox Dev Talks, well, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you do miss an episode, well, go along to voxdev.org. You'll find the episode there. You will also find articles about the papers we feature.